ॐ भरताय प्रतिबोधितां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कथितां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्ब त्वामनुसन्धामि भगवद्गीते भगवद्वर्षिणी. So on chapter 18, verse 54. Brahma-bhuta prasannātmā, na-shocati-na-kāṅkṣati, samasarveshu bhuteshu madbhaktim labhate param. Brahma bhutaha prasannatma na shochati na kankshati samaha sarveshu bhuteshu madbhaktim labhate param. So some of this we did, I'm just going to review some. Brahma-bhutaha literally means the one who has become Brahman. And if you remember us talking about this last week, the one who's become Brahman, you don't become Brahman, you are Brahman. Right? But you don't know you're Brahman. Since you don't know you're Brahman, it's as though becoming Brahman when that ajnanam is removed. So it's from the standpoint of the ajnanam, from the standpoint of the upadhi, it takes myself to be a jiva. Somebody's limited individual within this creation, taking myself, the Atma, to be limited in the form of this body, mind, sense organs, recognizes, as the ajnanam is removed, that one recognizes I am Brahman. That way I become Brahman. I become the Brahman that I've always been. Becoming Brahman through jnanam, not through any type of activity or accomplishment, through the removal of ignorance. So that Brahma-bhutaha, that one who has become Brahman, that one is prasannatma. Swamiji talks about prasanna atma. Atma here means mind. The mind is prasanna. The mind is cheerful. It's cheerful because it's whole and complete. Right? It's cheerful because nothing can happen to your being. It's cheerful because this body, mind, sense organs belongs to Ishvara, and that your being is Ishvara. Your being, the atma that you are, the self that you are, is the self which Ishvara is. And this body, mind, sense organs is part of this infinite creation, which comes from you, is sustained by you, and resolves into you. So I say, this is Ishvara, I'm the jiva. This body, mind, sense organs is the jiva, but it's like a wave in the ocean of Ishvara. But then reality, Ishvara is nothing but me, because the Atma, the self that I am, is the self which Ishvara is. Right? And so I become like a wave to the ocean, from the standpoint of the jiva, from the standpoint of the one who takes myself to be the body, mind, sense organs. I am the wave related to the ocean. And this body, mind, sense organs, in fact, it's a beautiful drishtanta, it's a beautiful illustration, because I recognize that every part of my experience, I can stop at the body in reference to the whole creation, I can talk about my prarabdha karma in reference to the whole ocean, right? Every experience that I have is part of the ocean, right? And so from the standpoint of the body, mind, sense organs, from the standpoint of the totality of my experience, because my sense organs are limited, my mind is limited, so I take the totality of my experience, all of that is only part of Ishvara. It's part of the ocean. But then, who am I in reference to the jiva, in reference to the prarabdha, in reference to the ocean? Who am I? It's like saying in the dream, when you have a dream, the dream, whole dream, comes from you, is sustained by you, resolves into you. You're not just the waker. Yeah, I mean, you're not just the character in the dream. The character in the dream belongs to the dream, but the dream comes from you. You see what I mean? the character, the experience of the dream character within the dream is like the wave to the ocean. It belongs to the dream. And so from its standpoint, it's limited. It doesn't have the sarvajñatam. It doesn't have the whole totality of experience that the whole dream has. It's limited and part and parcel of the dream, like wave to the ocean. But who are you? From the standpoint of the character in the dream, the character in the dream will say, I'm the conscious being who is this character in the dream. But what would the jnani character say? The jnani character in the dream would say, I am the self that I enjoy as my being is the self of the whole dream. Right? That's the vision. That's the vision. And you have to go. That's our situation here. This body, mind, sense organs, the very prarabdha karma, my whole life, all of my experiences, everything in my experience, this totality of my experience is Ishvara. But that's my little wave. It's my little wave of experience in infinite creation. And I take myself, this body, mind, sense organs, to be the center of my prarabdha karma. And it is from the standpoint of this jiva, right? But then you have your prarabdha karma, and you have your prarabdha karma, and all of our prarabdha karma is really just one wave, and we're all included in it. But we're each experiencing this wave from the standpoint of our own sense organs and mind, and yet we're all experiencing the same wave, so to speak. Our prarabdha karma is entangled, is joined together. But now when we realize, as you gain knowledge, you realize that just like all of you, from my perspective, all of you are objectified. I'm aware of all of you through my sense organs. And you're aware of everyone, right? That comes within your sphere. You're aware of all of those people. So I'm also an object of awareness to you. But you know what? I am also an object of awareness to me. Not just an object of awareness to you. For all of us, not only what we perceive external to the body is an object of awareness, the body itself is an object of awareness. Your sense organs are known to you, if they're working, if they're not working. Your thoughts are known to you. Your emotions are known to you. Even the I thought is known to you. The ahankara is known to you. Right? Even time and space are known to you. This whole scenario that includes your body, mind, sense organs is illumined, it's objectified, all of it. We don't tend to think that way. We tend to think of myself as the knower and this as the known. But we don't recognize that every part of the knower that makes the knower is also known. Right? My eyes are a seer, but the eyes are also seen. My ears are a hearer, but they're also objectified. See what I mean? The thoughts also, they think, the thoughts think, and there's feelings and all of these things, but those are all also objectified. They're also known. And when you get down to the bottom line, everything that you had taken yourself to be actually belongs to Bhagavan, belongs to Ishvara. It's all part of this creation, just like the dream, really. Right? And so then that just leaves you. Your being, the one who in fact is not objectified, but is self-evident. You can't objectify yourself and have a subject-object relationship with you. Then that thing that you're objectifying is who, then? So that's, you are the bottom line in terms of being, simply being. You are not objectified as part of time and space. So that's why when you're doing the meditation today, you see everything can be objectified, everything can be changed, everything can be improved, everything can be made worse. It can be made better, it can be made worse. Every experience that you have, you can impact it in one way or another. That's not true of you. Your being, you can't do anything to. You can't make it better, you can't make it worse. It's not objectified. It doesn't exist as an object within time and space. It's something which simply, changelessly abides as your very being. And as a jnani, you just learn to be yourself. The mind has gained knowledge. It's differentiated itself from you. It's differentiated the mithya from the satyam. It's like the pot recognizing I really have no being apart from clay. I am, in fact, the clay, but the clay is completely free of me. From the clay standpoint, there's no pot, there's just me. There's just clay. From the standpoint of me, all of these experiences that are coming and going, they have no essence apart from me. I am their being. And so if you sit just quietly relaxing with your experience, just the totality of your experience, your own presence, and then all of these fluttering thoughts, moods, emotions, perceptions coming from this end, that, and coming, all kinds of multi-processing going on, you just relax. You sit there and allow all of those to be. What is the experience? The experience is you are there, your stable, changeless being is there, and all of these things are coming and going. They have no essential nature. That's why if they're gone, nothing happens. When they're there, so they're there, they're there. When they're gone, they're gone. It doesn't, nothing happens. You remain the constant. And that's always the case. Our mind is so used to being very engaged with itself and with experiences within duality and creating emotions, creating tension, creating worries, being engaged, trying to make things happen and all this type of thing. It becomes very engaged in that. There's nothing wrong with being engaged in that, but the problem, if there's a problem with it, it's the problem of ajnana. Because being engaged in that, you have no recognition of any, there's no differentiation of your own being. While all that engagement is going on, where for ajnani, you can be juggling all kinds of balls and there's all kinds of things going on, but nothing's happening to you. Because your being has been differentiated, so the wholeness and stillness and the asangatvam of your presence, just being yourself, is always there. And the swarupa of that self, by its nature, you can say, is prasanna. That's why cheerful is not exactly the quiet word, but prasanna is. Prasanna means there is absolutely nothing wrong. It's absolutely whole presence, not to be improved upon. There is no sadness, there's no dukkha, there's no sorrow, there's no wanting to become anything else. There's peace, just the deep, deep peace. And the mind, Swamiji says cheerful, it's the mind resting in that deep wholeness, that deep well-being. So all is well with me. So there's that gentle smile on the face of the Murtis, you know, the Dakshinamurti or Gnaneshwari, that very beautiful, gentle smile. That's that prasanna. That's what it is. So if you just think in the, if you think of like the Dakshinamurti, all of the there's also this beautiful another Murti of Shiva, or the Buddha, you'll see in the Buddha that gentle, that beautiful, gentle smile. That's the prasannatma. So that one who has become Brahman means I've now recognized myself. My mind has that natural wholeness or cheerfulness. Nisochati, there's no grief. Because the self can't grieve. This is so important. Your self is not going to change. It can't grieve. Nikanchati, it can't desire things. It's not subject to raga and dvesha. It, yourself never wants to become this or wants to become that or wants to gain this or wants to gain that. Okay? Grief also or joy or elation? No. Because yourself is not an object participating in all of the world to be going through these type of modifications. It is whole and complete and changeless in itself. And so now, this is the beautiful thing. Whatever vrittis pass through your mind. If there's a grief vritti, vritti means the thought modification, emotion. Emotion passes through your mind. The emotion is there, the feeling is there, but it's mithya. The feeling passes through, it's mithya. Mithya means that it has no impact on your being. The feeling is there. It's not like you become without feeling. But yourself is always the same. And so the different tones and experiences that a person has are fine. There's nothing. There's nobody building up on them. The example they use in the Shastra is like a bird flying through the air, doesn't leave a trail. Mm-hmm. You know? So whatever experiences are happening, they're flying through the air. They don't leave a trail because nothing is happening to you. It's just, the thing is, this is just a simple fact. It's a fact that you have to notice. It's kind of like another example, riding on water. If there's riding on water, there's an impression being made, but as if the impression comes and it goes, like everything else. There's no one being up on it because your being, the wholeness of your being, is stable. The wholeness of your being is simply not changing as all of these fluctuating experiences come and go. And so that prasannatma, that stability of mind, is there because the mind is resting in the self, that it's differentiated and your self doesn't change. It's nothing you can do about it. Don't say like, I don't want myself to change. Your self has never changed at any time. It's too late. There's never a time, ever. And there is no possibility of your being having ever changed at any time, because your being is not an object within time and space. And so it's not a question of wanting it to not change or wanting it to change. It's a question of recognizing the truth. And then the question comes, is this being that is you, this me, do I want it to change? Do I really want it to change? You really don't, because if you changed, you wouldn't be here. You can want your mind to change, you can want your emotions to change, but even then that goes away, because why do you care? You know? Just help them. They are what they are. You just need to help them. They're not hurting you. So that's the Nishochati. The Nishochati, there's two ways to look at this. The Nishochati means you do that one who's become Brahman, recognize myself as Brahman, that one doesn't grieve. Firstly, Brahman never changes to grieve. Yourself never changes to be grieving. Second way, the mind is grieving is mithya, which means that I'm not grieving. My mithya mind is grieving. I can be with it and let it grieve. I can give it that love that it needs. I can give it that support that it needs. I can welcome it to be with me. Just like I would welcome another person who's grieving. I would want to help. So if my mind is grieving, I'm not grieving. And I'm not saying that as a theory. I mean, yourself is aparoksha. Yourself is immediate. It's present. You. You are not grieving amidst the grief. And so what will the buddhi do in that case? Just like if somebody else was grieving, then you would try to help. If your mind is grieving or your mind is wanting or something like that, then it needs some help. It needs to be cared for. And that's all that it is. Because your being is not grieving and your being isn't wanting anything. What about when your mind is, if your mind is needing those type of things, then it just needs some love or some care until it grows, until the raga dvesha and the wanting things to be different, your desires naturally drop off. That's a big thing to understand too. These desires or wanting things to be this way or wanting things to be that way, they drop off as you grow up as a child anyway. Somebody says, I always use the example, you may have really wanted balloons when you were little and they could have been very, very important. Very important. But when you grow up, the value of those balloons change. Mm-hmm. You could have fun with them, you could have a good time with them, and you can also easily let them go. It's nothing to you. Right? So it's not like this. The world isn't like this, but the world is like balloons. I can be with it, I can enjoy it, and I can also be free of it. Why? Because myself isn't really getting much out of the balloons one way or another. I am not changing by the presence or absence of balloons. You know, I'm not changing by the presence or absence of this experience or this experience. That's freedom. That means that allows me to be present fully, 100% to whatever experience is actually here. And then if the situation is problematic, then I can be useful. You know, If a situation is fun, I can have fun. If it's whatever it is, I can do what is there to be done. I can actually be here because nothing's at stake. So that's this prasannatma, that one whose mind is cheerful is the one whose mind is really has taken refuge, has resolved into the wholeness of myself. It nishochati nakanchati. It doesn't sorrow, and it also is not longing for this or that, because myself isn't improved by it. Myself is already whole. And such a person is samahat sarveshu sarvabhuteshu. This one means that is the same toward all beings. Swamiji talks about this. It's so simple. It's a really beautiful, actually. Same toward all beings. One is just recognizing as a human being, what is the basic dharma? What are the basic needs or wants for a human being? How do I want to be treated in any given situation? What would my needs be? How would I want to be treated? I know that that's how you want to be treated. Simple. How I would not want to be treated. It's assimilated knowledge. It becomes assimilated knowledge that how I would not want to be treated, you don't want to be treated in that way either, because you're also a human being. And I extend it, not I, the Shastra itself, you extend that to all beings. Extend it to all living beings. How would you want to be treated? How I would want to be treated, that's how I want to treat you. You know, and that's how I treat you. So when they say the one who is samaha toward all beings means the one who is same toward all beings. And the same toward all beings, the same means what? The same as I would be toward myself if that were I were in that situation. That is how I treat you. Okay? That's it. It's so simple. This is a dharma, the dharma that we all know. We all know this dharma, but we are only really have assimilated it toward how we should be treated. But that's what changes. There comes a time when how I would want to be treated is how I want to treat you. Where the way that I treat you is as important or as natural to me as, that's the way to say it, as natural to me, as natural as it is to me. I don't really have to think very much about how I want you all to treat me in any given situation. It's very clear. You know? But we all have that. That's why Swamiji will say dharma doesn't really have to be taught. It's innate, but it's only innate in reference to me. But that changes when you don't need anything. Right? When you don't need anything from people, or you don't need anything from Ishwara to be whole, then you can actually be present. And then the person that you actually are, the person that you actually are without kind of the mask of Ajnanam and the distortions brought about by Ajnanam, where my Ananda is projected out onto the world and then I have to manipulate, when that's not there, then that way of treating myself is also extended to other people naturally. So here, for the one Brahma Bhutaha, the one who has become Brahman, the one who has become themselves, who they actually are, that person is naturally cheerful. It's not really grieving or desiring anything in any type of real way, because by that I mean because yourself isn't. Right? And so all of those things become mithya. That person is samaha sarveshu bhuteshu. That person is the same toward all beings, including your own body, mind, sense organs. So that's a value that you naturally grow into. All of these things you naturally grow into, but also with the Karma Yoga, they become a value that you practice. Until they're just natural to you, as all of these type of effects of Ajnanam wear off, you know, that emotional lag time, they become a value that your mind hangs on to and practices. until the raga dvishas, all the likes and dislikes and all the unconscious material things have kind of worked their way through. So then he says, for this type of person, it's really talking now about the sannyasi, the person who's like this. Mad bhaktim labhate param. That person, he gains the param bhaktim, the highest bhakti, which is toward me, the highest devotion toward me. If you remember, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna has in two verses, he lists the four different types of bhakti, of devotion. One is for the arati, the first type, who is devoted to bhakti, mad bhakti. Mad bhakti means devotion to me as Ishwara. The first type is the arati. The arati is the one who, when they get in trouble, then Bhagavan comes into their life. They're not an atheist, but they don't ever think about Bhagavan at all. Until they get into some sort of jam, some sort of trouble. And then they'll go, Bhagavan, please come and help me. That's when they think about Bhagavan. When things are bad, then you need him, and so you pray to him. It's not that you're not an atheist, it's just that you're busy, right? And he's not in the forefront. The second type is called the artarti. The artarti is the one who not only thinks of Bhagavan when you're in trouble or in a jam, but when you have any new beginning. Like say you want to buy a house, or you're going to have a child, or any type of new beginning where you want Bhagavan's blessings, you want that Ishwara Nugraha, you want to invoke the grace of Ishwara. So you'll do rituals, or you do prayers, or you do whatever, do different pujas or whatnot, you know, just to invoke the grace of Ishwara for this particular endeavor. This is all of the time in India. Any new endeavor, there's always prayers and chants and pujas and things that are done in order to bless that endeavor. That's an artarti. So he will always, if there's something problematic, he'll always invoke Bhagavan, but also for any new beginning. So that's the artarti. The third one is the jignasu. The jignasu is the one who has become a mukshu. Now that one, what they want, the jignasu wants, is wants to know Bhagavan. I want to know you. I want to gain knowledge. I want to gain self-knowledge. I want to know you. I want to know myself. And so that one now is not really any longer, if they become a jignasu, one who wants to know, they're mukshu. They're no longer really interested in the realm of samsara. They've already now decided that all of these gains are really not gains. Everything that I thought was a gain, everything that I thought would make me whole and complete, I've realized that's not it. That's not what I want. I want to know you. I want to know the truth. That's a jignasu. The fourth one, which is considered the highest, Krishna is saying now, mad bhaktim param, the highest, the ultimate bhakti, is for the jnani. The jnani is the one who knows me. And now, in previous chapters, Ishwara says, in this, Krishna says, there is no one more dear to me than the one who knows me. There's no one more dear to me than the jnani, because the jnani is myself. The jnani, the one who knows, say I'm a jnani, then what does that mean? Is I know myself, and the self that I know is the very self of Ishwara, and the self of Ishwara, the self of the jiva, the self of the whole creation is the ananda, which is the most dear to everyone. And so there's something very beautiful in that. So he says, Krishna says, that most supreme bhakti, the one who is a bhakta, is the one who desires, who knows me. Desires to know me is the jignasu. The one who knows me. Because the one who knows me, right, to be a jnani, who is the self of that jnani? Me. The very me that is Ishwara, which for Ishvara is also the most dear. See what I mean? What is most dear to Ishvara is the self. What is most dear to all beings is only the self. The self may be projected out onto an object, but it's still the self that is most dear. Or say I project the self that is most dear onto an object, then that object becomes most dear as long as they're carrying the projection of the self. When they're not carrying the projection of the self, then they're just disposable. You know? What I love is the self. And so Ishvara says that one is the most dear who knows me, because the one who knows me is me. You see what I mean? It's an amazing thing. There is nothing more dear than the self, whether it be for Ishvara or for any jiva or for the whole creation itself. The Atman, which is Brahman, is the most dear. And so he says, that Brahma Buddha, the one who has become Brahman, means knows me, that one, you know, is the most dear. He attains that highest bhakti, the one who is the most dear to me, because he attains the self. That makes sense? It's really beautiful. So let's just look for a few more minutes at this next verse 55. Bhagramam abhijanati. Bhagyamam abhijanati yavanyaschasmitatvataha tato mam tatvato jnatva vishate taranantaram bhaktya mam abhijanati yavan yaha cha asmi tatvataha tataha mam tatvataha jnatva vishate tad anantaram. So now Krishna says, bhaktya mam abhijanati. Abhijanati from nya abhi, with abhi as the preposition. It means to know properly, to know thoroughly and completely. Abhijanati. Yaha, he who knows mom, me, knows me thoroughly, he who knows me, bhaktya, by bhakti. This fourth type of bhakti, I'll explain that in a minute. But bhakti is jnana lakshana bhakti, the bhakti of knowledge. So the one, but let's get into that in a minute. So the one who knows me, yavan, to my full extent, as much as I am, means who knows me, well, let me do it. He who knows me, the one, he who knows me as much as I am, that I, who I am in truth, asmi tatvata, how I really am in reality, and yavan, as much as I am. He who knows me, the self, as I am, as much as I am, and as I really am. So that's both in terms of the Ishvara Srupa, because I could be worshipping Bhagavan in the form of Krishna, or in the form of Dakshinamurti, or in the form of Jnaneshwari, thinking that that is Bhagavan. It is Bhagavan, but that's really just one form of Bhagavan. Bhagavan is the whole infinite creation. That's the whole Maya Upadhi, is Ishvara, and the truth, the Tattvataha, the reality of all of that is Brahman. Right? So when I think to know Ishvara is to know that this whole infinite creation is really just my being. Is this the self, the Atma, which is Brahman? That Atma, which is Brahman, is who I really am. So Ishvara will say, who I really am is the self, which you are, with this infinite Maya Upadhi, which really is nothing but me. Right? Satya Mitya. So the one, he who knows me as much as I am, fully, in terms of the Maya Upadhi, and also in reality, right, by that bhakti, then, having known that, me, tataha, then, thereafter, me, mom, tatataha, nyatwa, thereafter, having known me in reality, as I am, visheshate, tad anantram, thereafter, after that, He enters. He enters me. So it's not that when we say He enters me, then that has to be understood what that means. It's kind of like a wave, you know, recognizing recognizing that I am only water, enters the water. That's it. Does the wave enter the water? Well, he had taken himself to be a wave separate from the water when he realizes that I am the water. Right? Then he, as though, enters the water. Another example they use, you know, if I saw a log in half, and then it becomes two pieces. You saw the log in half, first thing you do, saw it in half, and thereafter, then, it becomes two. But actually, the sawing in half is the becoming two. And so here, the knowing is it, is that. So that thereafter, but without knowing, then even though that is the reality, from the standpoint of you as a jiva, because of the ajnanam, you take yourself to be a limited being. You take yourself to be a limited being that you aren't. Right? And so, what's the solution to that problem? You're taking yourself to be a limited being that you never have been. You know? So what are you going to do about that? You take yourself to be a limited being. You have never, ever been a limited being, but you take yourself to be the limited being. So what are we going to do to become the self that we already are? See the problem? We can't really do anything to become what we already are because we're already that. So the problem of becoming, it's called praptasya praptihi, the attainment of what's already there, the attainment of the attained. How can you attain, gain, something that you already are? You can't, because you're already that. So what is the problem? The problem is ajnanam, is that you are something and you don't know that you're that. And so that is the problem that our mind has. That's exactly the problem. I am what I seek, you know? But I don't know it. And so what I am is projected everywhere, and I go running after it. It's projected on this, and it's projected on that. And I run after it. There needs to be a viveka, there needs to be some recognition, you know, to remove that ajnanam, so I can recognize that one I've been seeking for beginningless time, trying to attain, trying to gain that wholeness, that completeness, that fullness, where I can say, actually, everything that is to be done has been done. I'm whole. I'm complete. Kritta krityaha. That which is to be done has been done. All is well with me. It's called the alam buddhi. For the jnani, there's this alam buddhi. Alam, the word alam, means it's enough. It's enough. It's fine. Swamiji uses the example. You know, in India, when if you go out to like a banquet or something, and everybody has the banana leaves on the floor, and you're all sitting around on the banana leaves, and then so you have your banana leaf, that's your plate, and so they'll come along, all of the servers will come along in these big buckets of food, you know, and then they'll put the food on, and they keep coming, you know, and at some point, you know, it's alum, it's enough. And so you have to put your hands out. You have to get their attention and put your hands out. Sometimes it'll go on your hands because they're coming so fast, you know. But it's enough. You don't want any more. You're full. You're completely full. It's enough. Food, that can happen even though it's temporary. With food, can do that. You can have an alum buddhi with food. So this is an alum buddhi. Somebody asked, do you want this or do you want that? No, I'm fine. Now, you want this? Would you like this? Do you need to know? I'm fine. That's the alam buddhi. My mind doesn't have that feeling of needing to do this or needing that in order to become full. I'm fine. It's an interesting to think, you know, as you become more that way. It's not something that you can, this doesn't, you can't just get rid of your raga dvesha's, your likes and dislikes. They all drop off. They drop off in time as you more you own yourself. But when you're just with yourself, you are fine. The ananda that you seek, you are. And then this situation is fine. This moment is fine. This group of people is fine. This life is fine. What I'm doing is fine. If something needs adjusted, I'll do it, and that's my dharma to take care of the situation. That's fine. This is my dharma to do this, to do that. That's my dharma. It's fine. Because I'm fine. And nobody can make me not fine. I can't even make me not fine. That's very important. Because we can be great spoilers to ourselves. Yeah, but I can't even do anything about it. Because yourself is not an object for anybody to act upon, including you. Right? And so in the recognition of the self, your mind becomes, it's kind of like, this is an example they use also, you know, like if you have a light and there's moths, how the moths will just naturally gravitate to the light. You gravitate toward Ananda. We all beings gravitate toward Ananda. And so if the Ananda is projected out into something else, there we go. We're after it. Because that's where we think it is. But what happens as you become settled in your knowledge and you no longer, your mind doesn't gravitate there. It gravitates just to being with you, and you're already here. So it doesn't have to go anywhere. So staying here, then the things that light up along the way, they're mitya, they're fine, they're enjoyable. But if they go away, that's fine. It's like balloons. The world becomes like balloons. You can enjoy the balloons, you can have fun with balloons, and if the balloons pop, it's absolutely fine. Because your being is not the balloon. The Ananda is not the balloon. And so balloon stands for everything, you know? Everything is like a balloon. Because you can be with the balloons and have fun with the balloons, and you can be without the balloons also. Not as any type of sacrifice, but because your mind is enjoying the source of the Ananda that used to be projected onto the balloons and isn't anymore. And so what about when the whole world falls into that category? That's just natural maturing of your knowledge. It's the natural maturing of your knowledge. You actually can't stop that from happening. You can't go back. In the Panchadashi, in the chapter 7, one student was thinking, he's getting all of this knowledge and was thinking, maybe I should wait, stop. go back to how it used to be. What's going to happen to me? And the teacher just said, I'm sorry, it's too late. You can't regain your ignorance. Not possible. You can't regain it. And the thing is that as you gain knowledge, when the knowledge is knowledge, what knowledge means is that it's actually true to the way things are. Otherwise it's called mithyajnana, it's not true to what it is. It's true to what it is. That's why we call it knowledge, otherwise we don't call it knowledge. It's a false knowledge, mithyajnana, which means a false conclusion of some sort. But knowledge means it's not dependent on you, knowledge is dependent on the way a thing actually is. That's what makes it knowledge. And so if you have knowledge of something, in the true sense of the word, then all of your experience will only validate it. You can't escape it. The world will validate. You know, try to make the world go against your knowledge. It cannot. It will only validate it. What it will go against is your ajnana. Your misconceptions, it will go against that, and they'll all get crushed. Knowledge will crush your misconceptions. But the knowledge that is true to the way things are will just become stronger and stronger and stronger, and the connections that you're making will go on being more infinite, endless. Endless connections, because the world is of this Nama-Rupa, the world of Ishwara, is endless. So there's continual validation, even in terms of the jiva, in terms of Ishwara, in terms of the mithyatva of the creation, in terms of the stability of your own being. You can't get away from it. It just becomes more and more and more clear. Even if you do not want it to. You can't get the snake back once you see the rope. You know? If you can try and try. But the more you try, the more you see the rope. And I think that's the situation. The more you try, get your ajnana back, the more you see the truth. It's too late. So, thank goodness, it's too late. So, let's stop there. Swasti-prajapya-paripalyantam Nyayena margena mahim mahishaha Gopramanebhyashubhamastu nityam Loka samasta sukino pavantu Kale varshatu parjanyaha Prithivi sasya shalini Desho yam chobarahitaha Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kaschit dukkha bhav bhavet Asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityorma amritangamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.
So I've wondered about this for a long, long time, but vritti thought modification, why aren't they just called thoughts or emotions? Or, you know, why not just use the word thought? Why say thought modification?
Which is what Swamiji says. I like to just say vritti. Vritti, the word vritti, actually just means an activity. Mm. Action. Some sort of an action. It could even mean a job. Job. Like a job is a vritti. Activity is a vritti, and action is a vritti. So when we say vritti, the full term is antakarana vritti. That, not just vritti, antakarana vritti.
Oh, so you should always think that.
Yeah, so when we're talking about vritti, it's because we don't use it in any other way, really. We always mean antakarana vritti. So the antakarana is the mind, an activity of the mind.
So it's like mental activity.
Mental activity. So Swamiji just says thought modification. The activity is that the mind is always modifying based upon the perceptions that are coming in.
What is it modifying?
Well, the vritti, one vritti changes into another vritti into vritti like
it's
that.
Modifying what came before.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
It's modifying its own shape, right?
Yeah. Yeah, because it's continually taking in data from the sense organs. That's one thing. It's taking in data from the sense perception, and then it has its own capacities. Its own capacities are these four, what we say, the citta, memory, type of vritti. That's not taking in data from the sense perception. That data's already been taken in, and you can recall it. That's called citta, memory. Then there's the manas, the fluctuating moods and emotions. That's a type of activity of the mind. Yes, those are vrittis also. And then there's the ahankara, and then there's the buddhi. These are activities that belong to the mind itself. And then, in addition to that, it's taking in all data from sense perception. So all of these modifications that are going on in the antakarana are called vrittis. And so if you just say thoughts, we could just say thoughts. I'm just used to saying thought modifications. Modifications of the mind, mental modifications, you could say. Modifications of the citta. Citta also, the word citta means memory. In the context of the ahankara, buddhi, manas, and citta, citta also means the mind stuff. It has different meanings. Also can mean consciousness, citta. So it depends upon the context if you're using the word. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So this matter of Sanskrit words meaning so many different things.
Not only do they often mean many different things, there are many different words that mean the same thing. Mm-hmm. Like, like for the word tree, we just think tree, and then you might think, well, apple tree and cherry tree and apricot tree. No, I'm talking tree. there are many words for tree. You know, like tadu, the one that has roots. Vriksha, the one that can be filled. And probably 50 more. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why words for space, words for aunt, word for mother, word for father, word for brother. You know, there's many, many, many different words. And so there's this dictionary. It's called Nirukta goes into the etymology of all the words. There's another one that's on the top of my tongue, tip of my tongue, but it, I'll probably think of it in a minute, but what it does is all of the synonyms. Mm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Does it start with A?
Mm-hmm. Amarakosha.
Yeah.
Edward. Yay. I have a couple of copies of it here, actually.
I remember. One Sanskrit thing.
Students will memorize the whole Amarakosha.
Who did?
Students will memorize. The whole, yeah, that's India. Yeah. Let alone memorize the whole Panini Sutras, they'll memorize the Amarakosha, the Nirukta, all the etymologies. It's amazing. That would be such a wonderful gift to have memorized. Yeah.
Do they have a word for for most deer? You kept referring to most deer, and that definitely.
They have different, like, priya means deer, and most deer you could say something like parama priya or parama ananda. Priya means deer.
But I find when I hear most deer, it becomes a little vague because I have to guess what's meant. Is there what could you?
What's meant by most dear is what is most loved by you. Parama prema. Prema means that. Priya, prema. What is the most loved? In all the things that are there to be loved, what do you love the most? That's what we mean by most dear. What is most dear for you? What it means what is most loved.
Yeah, but then that's kind of mysterious. It's hard to pinpoint. I mean, you try to locate that, what is most loved.
Well, you usually, when we think about it, we think, well, my parents are most loved, or my children are most loved, or my partner is most loved.
My pet.
Yeah, my pet is most loved. But in the Brihadaranyaka, Upanishad, I think it was Yajnavalkya says to Gargi, you love your husband for your own sake. You love your child. Your child is most dear to you because he makes you happy. Mm-hmm. So really, you are the one who is most dear. So there's a whole unfoldment that goes on to make you realize that actually the one who is the most dear to yourself is you.
I think that can be incredibly hard for some people to hear that.
Because
they think they're not being as loving then.
Yeah, that's right. But that's not true. But yeah. It's not true, but that's right. That's the first reaction. Then you feel selfish.
Real resistance to.
Yeah. So you have to be careful how you unfold that. Because there'll be so much immediate resistance. Like, no, no, no. But actually, what it is that ananda, or love itself, is the most dear. And so what is the source of love? And then you find out that the source of love is the self. And the self, there's one self. What is the self in all beings? So actually, Bhagavan is the most dear. Brahma is the most dear.
So whenever you you project this
ananda
sense of love outward,
then that
really
becomes the most dear.
Yeah, then that's the most dear. And so you can hop around and
you hop all over the place until finally you get to the source.
Yeah.
What do you say?
So, in reference to the verse, like you said, when you cut the log in half, that's the moment of two, being a two is not, and then it becomes two.
Exactly.
So in the verse then, when he says, soon after entering me, that's just a figure of speech.
Yes, exactly.
The moment you know, you're already there anyway, but the moment you know, it's as though you entered, not soon after.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
It means, it's just kind of a figure of speech or meaning right then.
Exactly. There's no time.
Yeah.
But until you make the cut, that won't happen.
Right.
But when you make the cut, it's there.
Yeah.
But until you make the cut, it's not there. Right? So you have to make the cut for that to be. But yeah.
I don't think I've heard that illustration before. Is that?
It's there. So Swamiji's used it before, but he's used it here in this context too, because that's what he talks about in his commentary. By the way, the commentary, all of it, this whole Gita is something to be studied over and over again, honestly. Mm-hmm. But this section, you know, these last few verses, and going all the way till the end is, it's just fantastic. Just read it over and over again. It's so good. It's just amazing. And it is in Shankara's commentary also, too, because this is Krishna wrapping up the whole teaching, you know, the whole Bhagavad Gita. And so Shankara has written a long commentary on it, and Swamiji has translated that, translated the commentary, but also really expanded on it. It's just so, so nice. After you spend all of these years going through the whole Gita, and then at the end, you know, it's like these last 10 verses there, the whole thing is, but you've spent all of these years sitting in that, and now he just ties it up in a nice little knot. But he's been tying it up all the way along, but now, you know, that we've lived with this for so long, now he's really making it, tying it up one final time for us. It's amazing. It's just, you have it. Yeah. I hope everybody's studying it.
You know, in chapter 18 now, which it's verse 2, he's talking about, he's saying the Antakarana Shukti, however, is not Kama Phala because very prayer itself is able to give Antakarana Shukti. Now,
where are you, chapter 18?
Well, that's just in the commentary. Yeah, it's chapter 18, verse, part of verse 2 of Swamiji's commentary. And I just wanted to know, how does this really work with, because we're just reading the whole chapter 18 right now.
Yeah.
And just kind of clarify anything that's not, it's just so much to it. So, how does this purification of the Antakarana Shukti, how does it exactly work? Because it's not a Kama Pala issue.
Okay, but really, when you're reading these, like this verse is saying, you know, some people say that sannyasa is the renunciation of kamya karmas, which is really going to be the karma yoga. So this is a whole discussion that's going on here, right? And he winds up this discussion over the next few verses. But you're taking something out of his commentary of that verse.
Yeah.
So tell me again.
So the question I really have is, if prayer is not really done for kamapala purpose, but actually for antakarana shukti purpose,
right?
How does it exactly work? How, what purification of the mind takes place through prayer? Because it seems like dana, spiritual discipline, dana, and rituals, these three things, seem to play a role some extent, and then they kind of fall away.
You said dana, right? Giving.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's three.
That's right.
Yeah.
But are you doing the, are you, for a samsari, who contained within the Vedas, you know, karma, in the Karmakanda, so samsari. These things are being done, prayers to Bhagavan, for certain gains.
Kamapala.
Karmapala. So I'm doing it so that I can go to heaven, or I'm doing it so that I can get a better next birth, or whatever. I have an intention that has to do with achieving something within samsara.
Right.
A mumukshu can do all of these same rituals. The intention is different.
Mm-hmm.
My intention is antakarana shuddhi. I'm doing all of these things, and the is for jnanam, for self-knowledge, for antakarana shuddhi. And so that is not a karmapala, right? That's gaining the mind that is necessary and the teaching that is necessary in order to gain self-knowledge. So antakarana shuddhi, the prayer for antakarana shuddhi is not considered a karmapala. The karmapalas are for gains within the creation that can better my lot.
Yeah.
Antakarana Shuddhi is not considered a karmapala.
Yeah.
Even though it is in the sense that I'm praying to Bhagavan or doing these to gain the grace and blessings of Ishwara to give me a mind that's capable of gaining this knowledge. But technically, we make that distinction.
Right, yeah. And so that distinction is getting somehow clear. At the same time, I'm still wondering, how is a prayer generating antakarma shuddhi exactly? And what is the mechanism there?
Well, say that you're doing actual karmas for with that as your sankalpa. Mm-hmm. Then you're just evoking the grace of Ishwara. Mm-hmm. So that you're evoking punya for that particular purpose. But now, mm-hmm. when we get into, say, karma yoga, which is actually coming in the next three or four, the next verse and the set of three verses or so after that, when I'm doing karma yoga, there's different levels of the karma yoga, because I can still have raga dvesha, mm-hmm. likes and dislikes. And then I'm doing those actions for a karma pala, mm-hmm. but with an attitude of accepting the results of that action as prasad. Mm-hmm. Right? And that neutralizes the reactions of my mind. Mm-hmm. I have a desire that's pressing. It's within dharma, that's important. It doesn't conflict with dharma. I go ahead and work for that thing, accepting the result mm-hmm. as prasad, that prasada buddhi. Prasada buddhi means when Bhagavan gives you something, you don't say, I don't want. So accepting, but that gives me the freedom to do that. And that gives me shanti, that way I accept it. Then as the karma yoga becomes, I don't know, the raga dveshas themselves have more or less dropped off, so I don't have so many desires, I need this and I need that. Then what I find is I'm just doing the karmas that are here. Mm-hmm. They call the kamya karmas are the karmas that I need this in order to be happy. Those drop off. Mm-hmm. But now I have my duties, you know, they're called the nitya karmas. The things that are in my prarabdha are the duties that are there. Those I do because they're there to be done. Mm-hmm. So I do them for the sake of Ishwara. That's the Ishwara Arpana Buddhi. So these are all attitudes of how to be in the world in such a way that my mind gains more shanti. And also becomes more and more like what is the natural mind of a jnani. You know, I'm kind of assimilating the mind of a jnani. Like, say, I have these desires, and I'm going up trying to fulfill these desires, but whatever happens, I accept as prasad from the Lord. So there's no reaction. There's no conflict. Mm-hmm. And then say those raga dveshas have dropped off, and now there's all of these duties that are to be done. And so I can say, I don't want to do these duties. I could have conflict. I say, I do these duties. These are my duties. This is what I do with an Ishwara Arpana Buddhi. This is what Bhagavan is given me to do, and so I do them. It's not about wanting or not wanting. That goes away. So first it's desires and accepting, you know, whatever Bhagavan gives as prasad. And then there's the life. Every moment, this is my duty, this is what Bhagavan's given me to be done, so I do it. It's not about wanting to do it or not wanting to do it, it's here to be done. So that raga dvesha, that level of raga dvesha goes away. And see, for a jnani, sannyasi, as the mind is, you know, matures, you just are doing what is to be done here in the moment, to the best of my ability. So I just do to the best of my ability what is here to be done. And he says, and that's it. It's very simple. Because the question is, what more do you want to do? Mm-hmm. There's plenty to be done right here. Your plate is full at this moment. Just think about it. It's really interesting to notice this. Your plate is always full. There's always things to be done that are right here at this moment to be done. So you can just live your life with the things that are being asked to be done now. But you're not initially going to be that way. Your mind just has all kinds of ideas about what it wants to do and what it wants to accomplish. And so that's why in that karma yoga buddhi, that let me do all of those things with that prasada buddhi. That's what's healthy. There's nothing wrong with that. And unless what you want to do is a dharmic, do those things, but do it with that prasada buddhi, and then the mind is released from a lot of grief.
And it's actually beautiful because in another verse later it says, you know, even the prayer that you think you're doing for Antakarma Shuddhi, you're not really doing for Antakarma Shuddhi, you're just doing because the Vedas say you've got to do it. And I kind of found that found that interesting too, because it's kind of like taking any wanting out of the whole equation. Mm.
At the end, even those karmas that are enjoined upon you, you're doing it because you're in the position for those to be done.
Yeah.
There's no ahankara there. That's what he's talking about. That there's no ahankara there at all. But you know that there's just a maturing process that's natural.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a way to be along with that through that whole process. Like, say you have raga dvaishas, what do you want to do? Hold your breath and pretend like you don't have them? You know, or say you really want to do this and you really want to do that, are you going to say, no, that's not necessary at all. The problem is if it's bad for you, if there's a part of you saying that's not right, that's not dharmic, that's not good, then just as a human being, it's kind of your duty to kind of rein that in, because it's... But if it's dharmic, and you have that drive, you know, then fulfill it. There's nothing wrong. Just have that karmayoga buddhi, and it brings the type of shanti. There comes a time when all of this drops off, because what you have is so fine. What you have is really fine, and you're happy with it, and you like living your life, you know, moment to moment to moment, then the mind isn't doing all of these things. Because you're engaged with your life. And the prarabdha karma takes you all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
I think maturing with your knowledge is kind of, Swamiji used the example of like a rose or like a flower unfolding. You want to enjoy its unfoldment, the unfoldment of this knowledge in your being, you know, in your mind and all the different parts of your mind, the unconscious and all of the things you've picked up on along the way as that flower kind of unfolds. You know, it's a beautiful process. So you don't want to try to rip open the leaves. So you've got a little rosebud and you know, you don't want to just let it beautifully flower. You want to, you know, like a child wanting to pull those leaves open, you know, this poor little thing. you need to enjoy the process of your mind maturing in the light of your knowledge. Such so beautiful.
This is so beautiful reading this.
I know.
I mean, it's so full.
That and the Vishnu. Swamiji says this book and the Vishnu Sahasranama, everything. The Bhagavad Gita, to me, when I'm studying it, it's just unbelievable that all of that has been written down. It's unbelievable. So, it's so much. It's so thorough. Because everything is there. I'll never get tired of reading it.
Yeah.